Dr. David Whetton earned his Ph.D. in organizational behavior from Cornell University. Prior to joining the Marriott School of Management faculty in 1994, he taught at the University of Illinois for 20 years, where he served as Associate Dean of the College of Commerce, Harry Gray Professor of Business Administration, and Director of the Office of Organizational Research. Appointed last September to direct BYU's Faculty Center, Professor Whetton is an active management trainer and consultant and edits for the Foundations for Organizational Science academic book series. He has published over 50 articles and books on the subjects of organizational relations, organizational identity, effectiveness and decline, and management education. His co-authored management text, Developing Management Skills, is in its third edition and has earned him the Distinguished Educator Award from the Organizational Teaching Society. He is a fellow of the Academy of Management, which honored him with its Distinguished Service Award, and has elected him to a leadership track that culminates in the National Academy presidency in the year 2000. David completed a tour of duty with his Army Reserve Unit in Vietnam. He has served a church mission and has been a bishop and a stake president. He currently serves as a ward high priest group leader. He is married to the former Zina Phelps, and they have four children. Professor Whetton enjoys traveling with his family, architectural and landscape design, and any activity that includes a view of the mountains. I present to you David A. Whetton.
At this year's graduation, I learned that one of our BYU slogans, Enter to Learn, Go Forth to Serve, was authored by Stuart Groh, a former faculty member in the Political Science Department. After participating in a particularly unsatisfying class on campus, in which the instructor lectured for hours in a most uninteresting manner, covering material that the students considered to be totally irrelevant, I drove past the signboard containing this slogan on my way home and thought to myself, if the rest of the university was patterned after my class, then we should change these words to read, enter to learn, go forth to suffer. Today I'd like to suggest we contemplate a more constructive variation of the enter to learn, go forth to serve theme. That is, enter to learn, to go forth to serve more effectively. This modification makes explicit the relationship between what we learn and how well we can serve. It is important that our graduates are both willing to serve and capable of serving effectively. I believe that a key for what students need to learn in order to serve more effectively is found in section 51 of the Doctrine and Covenants, verse 15. And thus I grant unto this people a privilege of organizing themselves according to my laws. Since coming to BYU 3 years ago, I welcomed the opportunity to explore in my organizational behavior classes and in my work at the Center for the Study of Values and Organizations, scriptural clues regarding God's organizing laws. I have chosen to address this subject in a BYU devotional because I believe that our potential to realize our unique educational mission is predicated upon our ability to successfully organize ourselves and our relationships according to God's laws, and to provide opportunities for our students to learn these organizing laws from our thoughtful instruction and our compelling example. Demonstration is superior to exposition as a teaching tool, and there should be no better example of how to implement God's laws of organizing than at BYU. In that regard, it is instructive to note that the word university originally meant a community, which in its normative sense connotes a supportive, invigorating, and ennobling learning environment. I truly believe that our ability to respond to President Bateman's charge to transform BYU from a university in Zion into a Zion University has as much to do with our success in implementing God's laws for organizing ourselves in our offices, our wards, our dormitories, and our athletic teams as with our success in integrating sacred and secular learning in our classrooms. To provide a common point of reference for my remarks, I'd like to begin by relating an experience taken from the diaries of Joseph Smith. During the second week of December, 1835, that Joseph spent several evenings participating in a debate at the home of his brother William in Kirtland, Ohio. The subject of the debate was whether it was necessary for God to reveal himself to man in order for us to experience happiness. Joseph spoke in favor of the proposition, which, given his intimate understanding of the subject and his forceful nature, undoubtedly contributed to his side winning the debate. At the conclusion of this activity, the future of the debate series was discussed. Joseph urged the group to disband, fearing, in his words, that it would result in no good. William opposed this position and became very angry. He refused to allow his brother Hiram to express his opinion on the subject, invoking his right as the owner of the home to manage the discussion as he saw fit. William's frustrations grew to the point that, according to the prophet, he used violence upon my person. A few days later, Joseph described this event and its effects. I left his home with feelings that were indescribable. The scenery had changed, all those expectations that I had cherished when going to his home of brotherly kindness, charity, forbearance, and natural affection that in duty binds us to not make each other offenders for a word. And with these marks of violence heaped upon me by a brother, I returned home, not able to sit down or to rise up without help. But through the blessings of God, I am now better. This experience was equally troubling to William, as reflected in the following letter he sent to Joseph. Brother Joseph, though I do not know but if I have forfeited all right and title to the word brother in consequence of what I have done, he then requested a release from his apostleship because then I would not bring so much disgrace upon the cause when I fall into temptation because of my passions. From the prophet's entry in his journal 2 weeks later, on the morning of January 1st, 1836, it is evident that although his physical wounds had healed, his emotional scars were still very painful. Quote, notwithstanding the gratitude that fills my heart and reflecting on the past year and the multiplied blessings that have crowned our heads, my heart is pained within me because of the difficulty that exists in my father's family. The devil has made a violent attack on Brother William and Brother Calvin, and the powers of darkness cast a gloomy shade over the minds of my brothers and sisters, which prevents them from seeing things as they really are. The powers of earth and hell seem combined to overthrow us and the church, causing a division in the family. The adversary is bringing into requisition all his subtlety to prevent the saints from being endowed by causing division among the 12 and the 70 and bickerings and jealousies among the elders and official members of the church. But I am determined that nothing on my part shall be lacking to amicably settle all family difficulties on this day, that the ensuing year may be spent in righteousness before God. Later that day, Joseph's father and uncle, his brothers Hiram and William and Martin Harris, attended a meeting in the prophet's home. According to Joseph's account, his father opened with prayer and then expressed his feelings with all the sympathy of a father whose feelings were wounded deeply on account of the difficulty that existed in his family. And while he addressed us, the Spirit of God rested upon us in mighty prayer, and our hearts were melted. Brother William made a humble confession and asked my forgiveness for the abuse he had offered me, and wherein I had been out of sorts with him, I asked his forgiveness. The spirit of confession and forgiveness was mutual among us all, and we covenanted with each other to strive from henceforward to build each other up in righteousness in all things and not listen to evil reports concerning each other, but like brethren, go to each other with our grievances in the spirit of meekness and be reconciled. and thereby promote our happiness and the happiness of our family, and in short, the happiness and well-being of all. This story illustrates what I consider to be God's core organizing processes: sanctification, edification, and unification, which work together to harmonize individual, interpersonal, and group spiritual development. None of these processes can operate independent of the others. We cannot become personally sanctified if we are not edifying others. And God's process of unification naturally emerges out of the edifying actions of sanctified individuals. It is clear that when Joseph and William were out of sorts with one another, they were out of touch with the Lord. Furthermore, as their rancor impaired their motivation and ability to serve each other, their usefulness as servants of the Lord was diminished. William's confession letter suggests that although he had been ordained an apostle, he was still struggling to subdue his violent temper, and this lack of self-control made it difficult for him to edify others. Fearing that his lack of personal sanctification would foster disharmony and unity among church leaders and members, he requested a release from this significant and holy service opportunity. Joseph's journal entries reflect his similar concerns about the adversary's use of adversity to create disharmony in the Smith family. He despaired that the darkness and gloom of persecution was causing his siblings to lose sight of their spiritual goals, which prevented them from seeing things as they really are. He was also concerned that jealousies and bickerings among church members were delaying plans to receive the endowment, which is a necessary step in the process of becoming one with God. It is instructive that the Spirit returned, and Joseph's despair about the effect of this incident on the spiritual welfare of his family and the church dissipated when he and his brother forgave each other and promised to reconcile their differences directly, to not listen to evil reports about each other, and to edify each other in all circumstances. Based on my study of these three organizing processes, I have concluded that if we enter BYU to learn how to become more sanctified, edified, and unified, we will go forth to serve more willingly and more effectively. Actually, my daughter Shauna got me thinking about this proposition several years ago when we lived in Illinois. After each of her semesters at BYU, I would ask her what significant lesson she had learned that term. Generally, she reported on her inspiring teachers, her interesting classes, her caring ward leaders, and her challenging part-time job. But her answer after one semester broke this pattern. She said, "The most valuable thing I've learned this term was how to be charitable, and I learned that lesson from my roommate." She has established for me a model of service and compassion that has changed my life. 2 weeks ago, my daughter graduated from BYU, and as a parent, I appreciate the outstanding education she received. I'm especially grateful for how her BYU experience has prepared her for a life of willing and effective service, particularly through her associations with a special group of roommates and friends. To sanctify means to make sacred and holy through purification. It is an intensely personal development process, as reflected in the prophet Helaman's description of his sanctified saints in Helaman 3:36. "Nevertheless, they did fast and pray oft, and did wax stronger in their humility, and firmer in the faith of Christ, unto the filling of their souls with joy and consolation, yea, even to the purifying and the sanctification of their hearts, which sanctification cometh because of their yielding their hearts unto God." Sanctification is made possible by the grace of Christ, as outlined in the following instructions for organizing the School of the Prophets in Doctrine and Covenants 88:74. "And I give unto you, who are the first laborers in this last kingdom, a commandment, that you assemble yourselves together and organize yourselves and prepare yourselves and sanctify yourselves, yea, purify your hearts and cleanse your hands and your feet before me, that I may make you clean. To edify means to build up, especially in regards to moral development. Edification is what we do for others that supports and enables their personal sanctification efforts. The Lord has counseled in Doctrine and Covenants 50, verses 23 to 24, "He that preacheth and he that receiveth according to the Spirit of truth understand one another, and both are edified and rejoice together. That which doth not edify is not of God and is darkness." As the saints prepared to leave Nauvoo 150 years ago this spring, the Lord gave their leader, Brigham Young, a set of specific organizing instructions for their journey, recorded in the 130 section of the Doctrine and Covenants. Verses 23 and 24 read, "Cease to contend one with another. Cease to speak evil one to another. Cease drunkenness, and let your words tend to edifying one another." To unify means to bring together into one, to organize properly. The importance of unity is reflected in the Lord's admonition, "If ye are not one, ye are not mine." Hugh Nibley helps us understand the relationship between God's laws of organizing and God's directive to become one. According to my notes from one of his talks, he said, "God's forces organize while Satan tries to disorganize. The natural state of order is one of disorder. Therefore, God's influence is necessary to achieve order and unity." Unity means to harmonize with something or someone. We are the most united when we are in harmony with God. In reviewing BYU's foundation documents, it is clear that the processes of sanctification, edification, and unification are central to the mission of BYU. At his inauguration, President Alan Oak stated, "Our reason for being is to be a university, but our reason for being a university is to encourage and prepare young women and men to rise to their full spiritual potential as sons and daughters of God." Elaborating on this theme, he later declared, "Brigham Young University seeks to improve and to sanctify itself for the sake of others, not for the praise of the world, but to serve the world better." At my first annual university conference as a new faculty member in 1994, Todd Britch, who was serving as academic vice president, helped me understand that the mission of BYU is broader and more important than what an outsider might conclude from observing our day-to-day activities of teaching and studying and administering. He said, "I have a deep desire for Brigham Young University to be excellent, for everything about it to be exemplary. But as I have been forced by circumstances to think beyond football victories, academic prizes, important publications, or brilliant lectures, I have returned to the conviction that for BYU to be excellent, it must first be good. That is, that we will never maintain or improve any important standard of academic achievement if we do not first attain the Lord's standards of virtue. I am convinced that our value as a university is dependent on our capacity to live together in charity." To help us attain the Lord's standards of virtue so that we can improve our standards of academic achievement, let us now turn our attention to three law-like propositions that illustrate the necessary interdependence between sanctification, edification, and unification. The first of these is, the edification of others is an essential requirement for personal sanctification. In other words, to become good, we must do good. If I understand correctly the plan of spiritual development outlined in the 93rd section of the Doctrine and Covenants, it involves the use of grace as both a process and an outcome. In verses 12 and 13, John the Revelator tells us that Christ progressed from grace to grace by receiving grace for grace. I take that to mean that Christ progressed from a lower state of perfection to a higher state of perfection through the process of receiving grace from God according to the grace Christ extended to others. Using our terminology, This interpretation indicates that our level of sanctification is directly related to our willingness to edify others by extending our grace to them, and just as important, by graciously receiving grace from them. One definition of grace that I learned as a student is doing something for someone else that they can't do for themselves and that they don't entirely merit. Following this logic, what is it that others at BYU need from us that they can't provide for themselves and for which they are not completely deserving? Roommates, shop clerks, teachers, security officers, coaches, administrators, and ward leaders need precisely the same things from us that we need from God and for which we are undeserving, including forgiveness for offense, overlooking the indiscretions inherent in immaturity, encouragement during periods of despair, and the motivation and power to transform weaknesses into strengths. Last year, I was asked to teach the core organizational behavior course in our executive MBA program. One evening, towards the end of the term, one of the students blurted out, "I'm frustrated by my constant inability to implement the good ideas I'm learning in this program because I have a boss who's over the hill, out of touch, defensive, and generally unsupportive of change. Would you please tell me how to solve this problem?" I can't remember the first time I was asked this question by a participant in a management seminar or course, but I will always remember the first time I was asked that question by a BYU student because I was startled by my response. At the University of Illinois, I was asked this question so often that I actually developed a set of rehearsed answers centered around the image of fencing in the dinosaurs. Half joking, I would tell my students that they would probably have to wait for a meteor to hit their organization before they would be permanently rid of all of their dinosaur managers. But in the meantime, they could construct barriers around them to help them from interfering in their activities and from sabotaging organizational change. In contrast, my response to this question as a BYU professor was quite different. I said something like, "Have you considered how your boss feels? Here is a person who once was competent, energetic, and successful, but now the changes he once enthusiastically promoted have doubled back on him, and he now feels alone, scared, and defensive." While keeping in mind important personal and organizational objectives, why don't you prayerfully consider the acts of charity that might restore your boss's faith and hope? I appreciate the environment at BYU that prompted this uncharacteristic but edifying response. The second of the three law-like propositions is personal sanctification is a necessary condition for the edification of others. In other words, we must be good in order to do good consistently. Soon after the organization of the church, the Lord instructed Oliver Cowdery in the proper discharge of his role as counselor and colleague to Joseph Smith. This instruction establishes a pattern for creating edifying relationships, even with those with faults and weaknesses. In the sixth section of the Doctrine and Covenants, verses 18 to 19, we read, "Therefore, be diligent, stand by my servant Joseph, faithfully in whatsoever difficult circumstances he may be in for the word's sake. Admonish him in his faults, and also receive admonition of him. Be patient, be sober, be temperate, have patience, faith, hope, and charity." The definition of admonition is counsel, advice, or caution, a gentle reproof or warning, to urge to duty, to remind of an obligation. Compare the tone and spirit of this definition with the definition of criticism, the act of passing severe judgment, censure, fault-finding. William and Joseph Smith were fortunate to have a righteous and sensitive counselor, their father. Who knows how much longer their disharmony would have lasted or how much more damage to their relationship would have occurred if their father had not taken the initiative to organize the process of reconciliation. I don't think it is by chance that Father Smith was the one who offered the opening prayer at their meeting, or that he counseled and admonished a prophet and an apostle to remember their duty as brothers rather than chastising them for their immature behavior. Because this counselor was in tune with the Spirit, his actions were in harmony with the Spirit, and the Spirit was present when hearts were ready to change. In reflecting on Father Smith's key role in this story, I was drawn to reread one of the classic talks on this subject given by my colleague and mentor, Bonner Ritchie, in a 1990 BYU devotional. He used as his text Psalms 55:14. We took sweet counsel together and walked into the house of God in company. There are three noteworthy elements of this instructive verse. First, the verb that is used is take, suggesting that we should focus as much on receiving and listening to counsel as on giving and enforcing counsel. Second, the instruction includes the modifier sweet, lest we are tempted to construe this verse to justify the use of critical counsel. Third, we are taught that the goal of sweet counsel should not be to advance our own self-interest, but to encourage and prepare us to walk into the house of God in company. In reflecting on how difficult it is to achieve the level of compassion and self-control necessary to do these things consistently, I have concluded that the best thing I can do to edify my students is to sanctify their teacher. We now turn to the final proposition. The goal of unification with others is made possible through a combination of personal sanctification and interpersonal edification. One of the few descriptions we have of a Zion society is recorded in 4th Nephi. We've all read this account of this blessed people who lived together in righteous harmony for two centuries. One of the most telling characteristics of this society was, according to verse 17, the fact that, quote, neither were there Lamanites nor any manner of ites, but they were in one, the children of Christ and heirs to the kingdom of God. I take this to mean that as a result of their transcendent state of unity with God and his teachings, the saints achieved an almost incomprehensible oneness with each other, exemplified by their lack of social distinctions, referred to here as ites. I assume that although the Nephites had, quote, all things in common, some of their families were still larger than others, and some adults were single and others were married. Some were raised in a rural culture while others were raised in large cities, and some spoke with accents, and some lived in large houses and some lived in small houses, and some wore traditional clothing while others preferred more modern attire, and some could read and write while others could not, and some were beautiful and others were homely, and some could trace their lineage back to Nephi while others were new converts. But because of their level of spiritual conversion and personal maturity, members of this Zion community chose to ignore these differences in the sense that they saw no need for distinctions. A difference is something that you observe. A distinction is something that you make. Distinctions are commonly used to include and to exclude for the purpose of creating status and privilege, because there was no more desire for privilege and advantage left in the hearts of these sanctified saints. They saw no need to affix non-edifying labels to their neighbors, and hence there were no manner of ites, but they were in one, the children of Christ and heirs to the kingdom of God. Recently, I've had several conversations with student and staff members on campus that have helped me better understand the need to eliminate one of the most divisive and pernicious ite-like distinctions that divides most universities, the difference between faculty and staff. Are you aware that nearly a third of our students work part-time on campus, and that the majority of them work under the supervision of one full-time staff member for 10 to 20 hours a week? I sought out this information regarding the scope of student employment on campus after learning about a number of life-changing experiences that have centered around a student employment relationship. The story of Joe, a freshman from a broken home and impoverished circumstances, is illustrative. After weeks of struggling with classes that assumed a level of understanding far surpassing his academic preparation, on top of working 20 hours a week and worrying about how to promote reconciliation among his disaffected and dispersed family members, his stressful circumstances finally overpowered his will to succeed. Late one night, this frightened and distraught member of our community made a desperate call for help to the one person he felt would be willing to listen and to care, his custodial supervisor. He received the reassurance and counsel he needed and expected and was able to complete the semester. Since hearing about many similar experiences, I am both disturbed and amused by my arrogant presumption that BYU is organized for the sole purpose of providing an opportunity for the faculty to influence the lives of our students. As I enter the Tanner Building early in the morning and observe our custodial student employees completing their work shift, I am humbled by the realization that their work supervisor has in many cases already had more personal contact with them than they will have from any other full-time employee at BYU for the rest of the day. Although I am familiar with an equally inspiring set of stories about the impact of caring faculty, I now realize that having a PhD or a faculty office is a difference that warrants no distinction on a campus that is dedicated to preparing its graduates for a life of continuous personal development through effective relationships, righteous living, and dedicated service. Paul Cox, Dean of General Education and Honors, recently shared with me an experience that exemplifies how well and how routinely the faculty, staff, and administration and the Board of Trustees work together to accomplish this common goal. Last November, one of our students, Mary Marsden, graduated magna cum laude with university honors under highly unusual circumstances. For 3 years, Mary fought valiantly to overcome her terminal illness. Paul expresses a real fondness for this young lady who for several years worked an early morning shift cleaning a building on campus, then rode her bicycle to the local hospital for her cancer treatment, and then returned to campus to attend a full schedule of classes. It was apparently not uncommon for her to leave a class in a mad dash to the restroom, where she would, in the privacy of a bathroom stall, suffer the painful effects of her medical condition and its treatment. In early November, Paul received a phone call from her oncologist informing him that Mary had been admitted to the hospital, probably for the last time. In response, the honor staff checked Mary's records and discovered that she was only a couple of credits short of graduation. After consulting with the faculty and associate deans, Paul received permission from the administration to hold a special graduation ceremony in Mary's hospital room. Elder Eyring requested the privilege of being the commencement speaker and joined his colleagues in their academic robes surrounding Mary's hospital bed. Paul's voice quivered as he told me this story, especially when he concluded by saying, "She died a few days after her BYU graduation." This unusually caring response to an unusual set of circumstances should inspire all of us to contribute more time, more concern, and more thought to our common goal of becoming a sanctified, edified, and unified academic community. It is important to remember that offense is necessary and inevitable in our mortal experience, even including our time at BYU. In fact, given the complexity of values embedded in our mission, the potential for offense may be higher at BYU than at other universities. However, given the richness of the counsel contained in our scriptures, including the words of our living prophets, we are also better prepared to respond to provocation in a constructive, edifying manner. To that end, I propose that we make a commitment to organize and govern ourselves according to the principles contained in the covenant entered into by Joseph and William Smith on New Year's Day, 1836. These include building each other up in righteousness in all things, not listening to evil reports concerning each other, going to each other with our grievances in the spirit of meekness and being reconciled. In conclusion, I testify that acting in accordance with God's laws of organizing enables us to sanctify ourselves, to edify others, and to unify all. I further testify that these three organizing processes comprised a match set, in that the effectiveness of each requires the presence of the others. I am grateful for the opportunity to participate in the process of transforming a University of Zion into a Zion University, and I pledge my improved efforts to helping BYU achieve this unique mission. To that end, as we pass the signboards at the entrance of campus each day, I invite all of us to contemplate how we might enter to learn how to go forth to serve more willingly and more effectively. In the name of Jesus Christ, amen.